Welcome to Faith Football Friends. I'm Chris Elrod, here with
Cole Parsley.
And I'm Forrest Santamaceres.
All right, we've got a great episode planned. We're excited to talk about this upcoming weekend's football Super Bowl matchup. And first, though, we're going to get started with our faith topic. And our faith topic is stewardship and generosity and giving and just making sure that Christians are being as generous as Christians need to be. So, Cole, why don't you get us started off here?
Okay, so this topic actually started off with a Facebook post I saw, and I shared it. I thought it was truth. And then I have about five rebukes later, a DM from a guy who didn't want to, who wanted to know exactly what I thought. You know, it's been brought to my attention. I still think it's true. Maybe the original post was a little too extreme, but it is something that's true, and I'm glad it's been brought up because it might be another one of those things that as Americans we need to hear, as Christians in America.
Okay,
Can
you tell us what the post is? Can you, like, talk about what the post is?
Yeah. So the post says, and in quotations here, this is the post: "I don't think people fully understand how much $1 billion is. If your salary was $100K with no tax, it would take you 10 years to become a millionaire, but 10,000 years to reach a billion. It is unethical for one person to be hoarding this much money when others cannot eat." So the post is saying it's unethical for a person to be a billionaire when other people are starving to death.
Yeah, okay. So I didn't say anything on Facebook because that's just not who I am. But obviously, like, we were texting back and forth about it for the audience's sake. And I don't necessarily agree with that because you're assuming that billionaires are hoarding money. Like, you know, and I mentioned this when we were texting earlier. There's billionaires who have done more for poor people than any of us ever could, right? And beyond that, there's billionaires who really didn't put that much effort toward being billionaires. Some of them are just, they inherit it. Or, you know, say for in the case of Bill Gates, he has $1 billion because he made an extremely successful company. All three of us own Xboxes. All three of us are using Skype, which is a product of Microsoft. Like, should he be penalized? Like, is it immoral for him to make a profit off of his talents and his work? Now, don't get me wrong. Should people be generous? Yes. But I've never met, or I don't even know of, a Christian billionaire. I know of some Christians who are millionaires, and from my understanding of them, they're very generous people, like more generous than I am with what I have. So, you know, when somebody's a billionaire and you say, well, there's people starving to death, like, okay, yeah. Like, is it bad that they have their money, though? Like, I guess that's where the disconnect is for me. And then how much would it be? Like, how much does it cost to feed everybody who's starving? Like, I don't know. You know, what are the means by which you would accomplish that? And then, you know, if I'm a billionaire and I live in New York City, what is my moral obligation to be aware of the starving people in a country thousands of miles away from me that I've never met?
And so really what you're challenging then is that it is like the part of the post that says it is unethical for a person to hoard that much money.
Well, like, yeah, exactly. And I do, like, okay, if they're hoarding it, then yeah, that's a problem. But the assumption that all billionaires are hoarding money, I don't think is true. Could they do more? Yeah, I suppose you can make that argument. But my thing is, how much money can they have and be moral? Like, if you're saying a billionaire, if you, 1 billion is hoarding, okay, is 999 million hoarding? Okay, is 998 million hoarding? Like, what's the number amount? Since the post brings up number amounts, like, what's the number amount that's no longer considered hoarding and why?
Yeah. In our text messages, we brought up, you know, I didn't want this. This isn't an objective saying. This is more of a principle because it is subjective. What number do you pick? But I want to bring up, a lot of people talk about Joel Osteen. He has this $1 million mansion. I don't know how much it is. is it unethical for a preacher, a Christian preacher, at least he professes, is it unethical for him to have that much money in just his home?
Personally, like, I don't think any dollar amount is what makes it unethical. Mm-hmm. Like, because you're saying it's a principle. If it's a principle, then it's a principle. We can't say this dollar amount in the house is ungodly. And I don't know his whole situation. Like, obviously, I don't support anything he preaches. But, like, you'd have to look. Like, just because you have a nice house, I don't think means you're ungodly with how you use your money.
Right.
Like, I would have to, like, I don't, like, there's like a step missing between that premise and that conclusion. You know, okay. Person A has a nice house, therefore, the way they use their money is ungodly.
And I think this was brought up, too, like, in the text messages, but I'll bring it up again anyway. Even though I was not the person that brought it up, honestly, I think Forrest brought it up. But, you know, if just because I'm not a billionaire, like, I still buy toys, you know what I mean? Like, I'm recording this podcast on a toy I bought. I'm wearing headphones on a toy that are essentially a toy that I just bought today so that, you know, the podcast could be better and stuff. So, like, you know, is that unethical? Like, I don't know. Like, at what point can we no longer buy things for ourselves? Like, I just think, like, there is a whole lot that goes into this that has to be considered and stuff.
And that's why I like this discussion, is because I think there is a wake-up call that some people need to hear, and that's the sense of, I do think it is a sin to sit by and continuously indulge yourself in the things of this world while you know of other people who need the help, especially children, like helpless children, right? That's my point. I do think that's a sin. Now, I say it's a principle, and it's not something objective, because, again, at what level do we hold each other accountable or ourselves? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. All I know is what the Bible says on this, and I do believe from what the Bible says that it is sinful to sit by as others need help and not help them.
Yeah, no, 100%, 100%. Like, I think that's true. And I think part of that is, I think there's a lot of things that go into that, but obviously, you know, I think it's a biblical principle, and we see it in the parable of the talents, for example, in Matthew 25. If you have the ability and you have the opportunity, you have the responsibility, right? If you can do something, the window opens for you to do it and you pass it by, you have failed a responsibility that you have. Like, I agree with that 100%. And I do think that we, especially in America, you know, can easily get caught up in this materialism. We can easily get caught up in the fear of missing out. We can easily get caught up in all these things. And we forget that there's people who truly need our help. But, like, I think the way you articulate that is different than, like, I know how you meant that post, Cole.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a lot of people who would share that post who don't mean it the same way. You know,
right. And that was the scary. Some people thought I was advocating for communism or socialism, and I wasn't at all. Not even close. Not to get political here. I know that's not why we do this. But I wasn't stating that the government should do anything. I was stating that as Christians, a billionaire in this case, it is wrong to hold that much money without helping others. And then the point that one person brought up was that billionaires, it's not like that's in their bank account. Now, it may be in some cases. We don't know. And I guess you can say it's their money. And part of this goes with, well, you can't tell anybody how they should use their money. They earned it. It's theirs. And one of the things I want to bring up is, no, it's not really theirs. It's God's at the end of the day. They may have worked hard for it, whereas somebody might not have. But at the end of the day, we're stewards. And the things we've been blessed with, we got to use wisely with our Christian calling and to help others. And there's also a principle, of course, of enjoying those things in the Bible, but.
No, absolutely. And you're right. Like, we can't tell people how to use their money, but God can, you know?
Exactly.
And there is the expectation that Christians are generous, and there is the expectation that we're going to help people, you know? And if you are blessed with an abundance of money, or if you're blessed with a little bit of money and you have the opportunity to use some of that to help someone else, I think the expectation is that you would help someone else, or that you would be willing to give that money. The parable I thought of was the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, like, that's a perfect example. And I know in Luke 10 there, Jesus is answering the question of, well, who is my neighbor? And he's trying to get it across that, you know, that race does not define who your neighbor is, that anybody can be your neighbor. And but the one of the themes of that parable is certainly that we should help and be willing to help, helpful rather, to anyone that needs our help.
Yeah, for sure. And I was going to read 1 Timothy 6:17-19. And I think this is exactly what you just said, Chris. It says, "As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be prideful, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, and to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life." So this, like, there is an expectation laid on the rich in this present age who are submitting to Christ to use those riches in a God-glorifying way, not to trust in those riches, but to take hold of true riches, which is eternal life. So you definitely have an obligation and a moral responsibility if you, like, you know, if you're rich. But at the same time, like, this all goes back to, like, I don't know why we're surprised when worldly rich people don't use their money to help others.
No, that's, like, a valid point.
Like, how do you expect people with billions of dollars who don't even believe in God to use their money?
Right. No, yeah, that's extremely valid. And I feel like that's a concept or a principle we've kind of talked about a lot throughout our friendship. But no, I think that's a very good point. You know, you can't expect non-Christians to live like Christians. Like, and whenever we do that, we're being foolish, you know? Because, like,
yeah,
God's word doesn't even set up that principle, you know?
Right. Yeah. But I do think, like, kind of like Cole was saying, the moral obligation exists nevertheless. Like, I would agree with that. Like,
absolutely.
It's still
absolutely
a sin, you know? But I also would say that, just quickly, it kind of escaped me. Oh, yeah. So, like, I think the way that we fix it, and I know you weren't advocating for socialism, and I know we probably don't want to even get in that on that episode. I have very strong feelings about that. But, like, if you want billionaires to share their money, you know, the solution isn't to force them to do it. I think the solution is to convert them to Christ.
Right.
And absolutely, not only that, but if we can have an impact on them by leading the way. Like, think about the account of the woman who gave the one mite into the treasury. Jesus says she gave more because she gave out of her poverty, while the Pharisees gave out of their abundance. And it was to the Pharisees' shame that this poor woman was giving to the treasury. She was giving less money, but she was giving a higher percentage of what she had. And I think if, you know, we, like, all of us just kind of middle of the road Americans, maybe a little less than middle class, we're still rich when you look at the whole world over. Like, if we led the way in being charitable and being giving and tried to reach everyone we could with the gospel, like, I believe, like, that's the way you fix it. You know, like, it starts with us reaching out to people and us, like, walking the walk, you know,
rather than pointing fingers at the billionaires all the time who, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that widow that you just mentioned, Forrest, like, she's kind of like my role model in giving, you know, because I think the concept there is that, like, or what it seems like to me that she did is she gave in a very uncomfortable way, you know?
Yeah.
And the way I've always been taught to give is, like, you budget for it and then you give what you budgeted. But, like, I don't know that that's really the biblical way of doing it. Now, of course, like, I think being responsible with your money and having a budget is a good thing. I think it's something that God even expects us to do, because he expects us to be good stewards. But at the same time, like, I think we should be willing to go beyond that and give even more so that we can help someone, or so that we are just challenging ourselves more and more to live for God and to trust in God and just to, you know, believe that God's going to take care of us.
Yeah, and I think that was the widow's situation. She was comfortable giving everything she had because she trusted God to take care of her.
Right. No, absolutely.
And that's a big point, because a lot of these riches is people hoard them up because it gives them security. Well, I can't give anything to anyone else because then what am I going to do about myself? And sometimes that goes to extremes. You know, people will have way more than they need or could need in 10 years, and they're still unwilling to give because they sense their security in money. Their idol, if you will, is in money. Lost my train of thought.
Oh, real quick. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it reminds me of, if you guys have read The Hobbit or watched the movies, the dragon Smaug, he's like symbolic of what you're talking about. And the way the dragon works in The Hobbit is, like, he can't even spend money. He just loves it so much, he just sleeps underneath it. Like, he just loves the feeling of gold. Like, he just wants to be around it. And he will kill anybody who tries to take any of it from him. Like, and it's not that he's even using it for any good purpose or anything. Like, there's no dragon market he can go to and buy stuff. He just wants it. And, like, that idea, and that's even, you know, in the Bible, when it talks about being a lover of money, it's literally a lover of silver. And when you start loving money, not for what it can get you, but for what it is in and of itself, like, that's when you really got some problems.
Yeah. I want to bring up the question of, and I think we alluded to this, so we know we need to give. We know we need to be good stewards and to manage God's resources wisely to help others. But what does that entail? How much do we need to give to be, quote unquote, okay, to not be sinful, to not be unethical? And I want to start out with saying, I ain't got a clue. I think you already alluded to the fact that as Americans, we are rich. Like, we are rich. If you compare us to Jesus's day, we're absolutely rich. If you compare us to the rest of the world, we are rich. So how much do we need to be giving? I want to bring up what John the Baptist says, and I'm sure y'all are aware of it. he calls the Pharisees, "You brood of vipers." He says, "Who warned you of the wrath to come?" Telling them to repent. Then they said, "What shall we do?" And he says, "Two tunics, two shirts. Give one to someone who has none, to someone in need." So that's a pretty extreme... That's pretty extreme giving right there. Is he being extreme? Is this a hyperbole? What do y'all think?
I don't think he's being extreme. I think the principle here is, if you have more than you need, give to those who need. Like, I don't think it's... But, like, you're saying, you know, you kept referring to this as a principle, and it is a principle, which means there's no number on it. There's no amount on it. Like, you know, what if you had 8 tunics? Would you have to give away 4? Would you have to give away
7?
Would you have to give away 7? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, how many do you give away? So I think that's obviously, but I do think there's an argument for Christian minimalism, and this is like a whole nother podcast episode. But I think we, by and large, do have way more than we need. All three of us, I think, if we went to our closet, 70 to 90% of our clothes we don't wear. Like, probably, most likely. And there's people who, you know, could use that stuff. So I think that's a good reminder. But, you know, I think the principles you have in the New Testament are just that, principles. If this is your temptation, if this is your stumbling block, then obviously you need to be more radical in your giving than other people. But when you read about it, you have these principles like giving as you've purposed in your heart, giving cheerfully, giving out of your need. So even when you have needs, you still are to give. You know, if the person with no tunic gets a tunic, but he's got 2 loaves of bread, what would he have to do? You know, and it is a principle, but still, like, that idea, I think, carries through. But there's no, like, there can't be a set amount, you know?
Right. I think looking for a set amount is kind of like asking,
what's the bare minimum I could do?
Well, it's like asking, what's the bare minimum I can do? But it's also like, it's kind of like similar to, like, you know, asking, like, how far is too far in a dating relationship? You know what I mean? Like, like, yeah. as Christians, like, we shouldn't, like, you know, be seeking to do the bare minimum. We shouldn't be seeking to go as far to the line as possible or, you know, anything like that. We should just strive to be as much like God as possible. And, you know, we can't forget that God is the ultimate giver, the best example. And I mean, he has given us way more than we can ever give back to him or to anyone else. Cole?
Yeah. I think it's just, I love that you brought that up because as Forrest just mentioned, 1 Corinthians talks about giving with a cheerful heart. Like you don't want to give if you don't have the heart to give. You want to give if you feel the need to give and you want to help somebody and that's fruitful for you. Like you can't serve God and money. Two of the greatest commandments was love God and then love your neighbor as yourself. So it's more of not letting your heart be having a love for money, but letting your heart have a love for helping others. And then all of a sudden you're not losing anything when you give for other people. You're enjoying that. Francis Chan, I'm sure y'all are aware of him, popular preacher. He, in one of his YouTube videos, he talks about how he would rather keep his old, rustic, worn-down van. He drives a minivan, and people are always asking him, why do you drive a minivan? We know we will buy you a new car. And he says, I would rather drive this minivan than spend 30 grand on a new vehicle when I can use that 30 grand to help orphans. And now all of a sudden, every time I look at my van, I remember that gift I gave them.
Right.
And that's the difference is, do I want to spend my money on the brand new iPhone, even though I have the iPhone 7? Or do I want to spend this $300 to give some poor kid a new pair of shoes? Right. I think that's the difference.
That new iPhone would be like $1,100 too.
So, right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But no, I think that's a great point, you know, like, and I think that's a way that we can give as Christians, you know, maybe we can simply go without some of the nicest things so that we can, you know, be more generous.
Yeah, that's minimalism, as Forrest was stating.
Yeah, and I would say, like, the fact that it starts in the heart is important. When I took the ACT, my prompt for the writing portion was, should colleges require a certain number of volunteer hours for admission? And I wrote a very lengthy essay on defending, no, they shouldn't. Because once volunteerism is required, it's no longer volunteerism. And that's something that I think people sometimes forget. They're like, God, just tell me how much to give. Tell me how much to give. God's not going to compel you to give anything. Like, that's the whole point of this concept, you know? Like, it's up to me to actually truly want to do it.
But he is going to compel you to give by giving to you and showing you how to be a blessing to others by blessing you to some degree as well, you know? And I think it kind of goes back to, like, the concept of, I believe it's Genesis 12, where it talks about how Abraham is blessed in order to be a blessing to others. And I think as we have been so blessed that God is in a large way. Now I understand what you're saying, but God is in a large way telling us or showing us and compelling us to be generous and to be givers because of how blessed we are.
And I think that's also circular because God blesses us. So we bless others. And then as we bless others, there's a biblical principle there of God's going to bless us more. I think it's important that we close the subject out with two sobering passages. If there's any hearers out there who aren't totally convinced, this is kind of like the nail in the coffin, if you will, the mic drop, in that it is sinful to sit idly by while others need your help. Amos chapter 6, verses 4 through 7 says, "Woe to those who lie on beds of ivory and stretch themselves out on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp, and like David, invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. Therefore, they shall now be the first of those who go into exile, and the revelry of those who stretch themselves out shall pass away." it's not bad that they had the best lamb or the best meat or wine. They were laying and resting in beds. That's not the problem here. The problem is they are doing that while their neighbors need their help. That was the issue at hand. The second passage that's really sobering comes talking about the final judgment, what it's going to be like. This is Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. It says, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people from one another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me.' Then the righteous will answer him, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?' And the king will answer them, 'Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me.' Then he will say to those on his left, 'Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me. Naked and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison and you did not visit me.' Then they will also answer, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison, and did not minister to you?' Then he will answer them, saying, 'Truly, I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me.' And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life."
And there you have it, guys. I think it's very clear that we have a responsibility to help those who need our help, whether financially or otherwise, but especially financially, especially as we look at how God has blessed our lives so richly. You know, God is the ultimate giver, and so we should strive to be as generous as God has been. And now, obviously, we can never be as generous as God has been to us, but we can certainly strive to give cheerfully to those who might be in need. And so let's all strive to be more generous. Thank you for listening, and we will move on to the football section. Well, I think one thing is certain, that and that is that no one is going to be giving away points at Super Bowl 54 this Sunday. Guys, are you excited about the game? Are you thinking are you thinking it's going to be a good game? Are you still just throwing a fit because the Titans aren't in there? What's going on? What are your opinions on this weekend's game?
I think it's an old-fashioned good defense, mediocre offense versus a stellar offense, mediocre defense, right? So big offense versus big defense, who's going to win?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I don't know, man. It's hard for, like, that offense is so explosive. I'm rooting for the Kansas City Chiefs. I think they've got it, but I don't know. I know Forrest might have another opinion.
Here's my thing. I've been thinking about this a lot. You guys know my wife is a big Kansas City Chiefs fan, and that makes me upset for a number of reasons. Patrick Mahomes is her favorite player, which makes me upset for a number of reasons.
Who can blame her? He's so good.
So I've been saying the Niners are going to win it, like hands down, hands down, hands down. But then I heard something on some sports show I was watching that made me rethink that. Because it's not just that. Okay, so obviously the classic example we've talked about in the last five episodes is the Denver Broncos with Peyton Manning, the best statistical offense in the history of the NFL, going into the Super Bowl and being absolutely destroyed by the Seattle Seahawks. We've talked about that to the point where it makes me want to vomit. The thing is, here's the key difference. I was listening to a show the other week, and the other day, and they talked about how in that game against the Titans, Do you guys remember the Kansas City Chiefs' first offensive possession?
We stopped them, right?
Yeah, they punted. There was a loss of yards on short pass. There was barely anything on a run. Then there was an almost sack on Mahomes on third down, and then they punted. They reported that after that happened, Andy Reid threw away the original game plan he had and pulled another one up. So I think the difference is here going to be a certain amount of flexibility that Andy Reid has because of the talent on that team. See, the Denver Broncos explosive offense, but pretty one-dimensional. The run game was non-existent, and you were depending on Peyton Manning, who is only a pocket passer. Mm-hmm. So I think the flexibility of the Chiefs really gives them an edge here, because if you can just throw out a game plan and then just bring up another one and win, come on. You know what I mean? He could do the same thing against the 49ers. If it doesn't work at first, that's okay. We'll adapt. They've got so deep that they can go to that really, every play ever written, they can run because of the talent that they have. So I think that they might have the edge, but still, the old adage is an old adage for a reason. Defense wins championships, and I think that's where the game really is. If the Kansas City Chiefs defense can stop the second highest scoring offense in the league, the 49ers, then they'll win, obviously. But I would say 49ers statistically, they're better than mediocre. They put up a lot of points in the regular season. So either way, it's the most excited I've been for a Super Bowl in a number of years.
No, I agree. I think it's going to be a great Super Bowl for sure. And I think
I would
that...
also say...
All right, ahead. Why don't you just say what you want to say?
I would also say that the Chiefs...
Are you sure?
They're not that terrible as a D-line.
Are you sure?
Their D-line shut down the Titans' offensive line. That's a big deal.
And
that's fair. I don't know. I agree, but go ahead. Sorry, Forrest.
They did better, way better than you thought they would. At least, way better than I thought.
That's absolutely true. No,
I would say defensively, and you could say, "Oh, well, it was different. The scheme was different. Whatever." Defensively, they outplayed the Patriots and the Ravens, which is not something you would expect to see. And
that's true.
Obviously, their defensive backs aren't fantastic. But their safety is good enough that you can leave them on an island and still feel like you can stop people. So, all the pieces are there. It's going to be a great game either way. But I read a story earlier where somebody, and obviously none of us here are gamblers, but somebody placed a $550,000 bet that the Kansas City Chiefs would win. And it was such a big bet that it moved. It made, the bookies adjust how favored Kansas City was, on the over under on the points.
Wow.
Yeah, it was that big of a bet. So I don't know if somebody knows something we don't or what. Maybe it's already rigged. I don't know. But that's a massive amount of money.
If Patrick Mahomes gets the coronavirus, there goes his $550,000, right?
That's true. You think Patrick Mahomes is the one who bet that money?
Ooh.
No way. No way.
I wonder.
It could be.
Little Pete Rose action?
I mean, it almost... Oh, yeah. It is illegal for them to gamble, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
The NFL. Yeah. And so, no. I'd say he didn't. Because if he got caught, there goes his money.
Yeah.
You know? That's kind of risky. Not to mention...
Everything else.
Chiefs would be... angry. I didn't know that, though, about the game plan. That's interesting.
Well, so originally the whole game plan, Andy Reid said they were going to run RPO the entire time because he saw something in the film where y'all struggled against the RPO, and then the Ravens could never get that going because they were losing so quickly. They were already down so fast in the game, they could never get the RPO going. They had to start chucking it down the field. And he said they've never really, whenever they struggle, it's against RPO. We're running RPO. They run RPO, have to punt. He says, forget it. They didn't run another RPO the entire game.
That's wild. That's so wild because, it's crazy to me that he thought that was going to work just because of our success against the Ravens. I guess I understand what you're saying about us being ahead, but like that was kind of the Ravens' strength. Whenever we were able to get past that, like if I don't know, I don't know why he was surprised. I guess that's why he had another game plan. But at the same time, I do think it's interesting. Like Patrick Mahomes' legs, to some degree, is really what made a huge difference in that game. Now I know, like he like played great and threw great and all of that, but I feel like his legs was the X factor that we weren't really prepared for. You know, I feel like we were ready for him as a Peyton Manning style quarterback, and come to find out, dude can run. So he
absolutely. And I think, and I'm not saying this like I'm not a Titans fan at all. I'm not saying this to get you guys out of anything. Well, okay, I root for them because my best friends root for them, but I'm not like diehard. That's what I mean.
Thank you for correcting that.
Yeah, no problem. That run, that famous run, that's going to be shown over and over again, where Mahomes make you guys look silly and then scores with his legs. If you watch that, Titans players are pulling up because Mahomes is running towards the sideline. And if you hit a quarterback out of bounds, it's an automatic 15 yards. Like the way the league protects quarterbacks is good for people like Mahomes who aren't all about their legs. See, quarterbacks who are all about their legs, Cam Newton, Lamar Jackson, Mike Vick, never get calls. They never get calls because refs see them as a running back. But if you run selectively enough to be dangerous, but it's not your thing, like Mahomes, you get those calls and people know it and they're scared to hit you. And I'm not saying he had nothing to do with it, but like if you watch those first two missed tackles, the dudes are pulling up because he's running towards the sideline, but then he sidelines it the rest of the way.
Yeah. I think that's really where that play, though, also, I see what you're saying, and that makes sense, but I think it was not having Malcolm Butler, and I may have said this last week, so I don't want to repeat myself, but, you know, I think the cornerback, Brock, I think is his last name, he was, like, totally trying to strip the ball and should have just tackled the guy, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
That's what really killed me.
Who knows? Who knows what would have happened if we'd have just tackled him there? But you can say that about every game. Anybody who loses can say that in any game. Yeah. So
you could say that about every scoring play. Oh, if we tackled the guy, it wouldn't have. You know what I mean? But there was a missed opportunity. There was a missed opportunity.
Yeah. Right. Like there was definitely a missed opportunity because like the dude like basically just held onto his arm as he trotted into the end zone, clawing at the ball.
And we all played Pee Wee football. Like, one of the first things you learn, if you want to tackle somebody, what do? Like, sure thing. You wrap up their legs.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's something my coach emphasized. And he always said the lowest man wins every single time. The lowest man wins. You can't run if your legs can't move. You can run if somebody's grabbing onto your bicep. Like, I don't know.
Right.
And I'm not saying, like, I know better than him. I'm just saying, like, what are you going for there, you know?
Right. And the guy did play great other than that, but I don't know. I see what you're saying definitely, though, about the versatility of the Chiefs offense. Like, I definitely think that gives them an edge. I don't feel like this game is a great defense versus great offense. I think this is just a great offense with a decent defense going up against one of the best well-rounded teams. Like, that's how I see the 49ers. You know, like,
That's more accurate, for sure.
I don't think they're, you know, dominant on any side of the ball, but they are well put together on every side of the ball.
Well, okay, so is their defense? I'm not that well attuned with the 49ers. Is their defense, like, elite? Are they the Seahawks of 2013 or whatever it was?
I mean, they're definitely, like, explosive-wise, they're not... I don't think they're the same as the Seahawks were. But statistically, and I know you got to take stats for with a grain of salt, Cole. I know you're an advocate for not trusting stats all the way. Mm-hmm. But statistically, like, their defense is good. Like, they're one of the best defenses out there. They've got a +4 turnover ratio. They allowed half as many touchdowns as they scored, less than half as many as they scored. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? They, they're good. Like but I wouldn't say like this is like an all-time defense. Like I see what Chris is saying. Like you're not going to say this is an all-time defense, but they have all the right pieces. They've got backs that stand out. They have an insane edge rusher. They got a pot roast in the middle, and that with a good scheme makes you win a lot of games, you know? Yeah. And then the offense.
No, I don't know. What is a pot roast in the middle? I never heard that.
Just a big dude. You have a big dude, like a nose tackle, like a 300-pound nose tackle, just plugging up the middle. Gotcha. And then the offense, like you look at their offense, Jimmy G, like there's another thing I read today, which is interesting. We've kind of been sleeping on Jimmy G because he threw 8 passes in the win against the Green Bay Packers. But something we forget, Jimmy G was handpicked by Bill Belichick to be Tom Brady's replacement when Tom Brady left. Like, he's not a slouch. Like, he was the heir apparent of the Patriots dynasty if Brady retired when he should have.
And I read a story. He got groomed by Brady.
Right, right. And I read a story earlier where Bill Belichick told Troy Aikman that, quote, if anything happens to Tom Brady, Jimmy G can win for us. And Troy Aikman's point is, when Bill Belichick talks about winning, he's not talking about winning week 3. He's talking about winning the Super Bowl. Like, that's how much trust Bill Belichick had in Jimmy G. So, like, I think some of the criticism toward him is unfair. Like, they're going to do what they have to do to win. Jimmy G can put it on when he has to. And, like, they're just dangerous enough with just a good enough defense that, like, it's going to be a great game, like I keep saying.
Here's something. Jimmy G is probably the most rare first-round draft quarterback we have ever seen. Like, he got drafted in the first round, right? It was the first round, I'm pretty sure. And he never got an opportunity because he was just living in Tom Brady's shadow, and now he's getting his opportunity. And so we all kind of, I guess, the media wrote him off, but he never got to prove himself.
Yeah,
but and all then, of a sudden, I don't know. It's even better because he was groomed by Brady. Go ahead.
And I don't know if you guys remember. I'm just checking the draft. He was drafted in the second round. But that's okay. First round quarterbacks are rarely good, which is an interesting phenomenon. But the thing, the thing with Jimmy G is it was almost like he's good, but it was almost a disservice to the Patriots that they had to play him. Because that time when he had to come out, when he had to come out on the field and play that year Tom Brady was hurt, people got to see how good he was. And that's how he was able to sign the fat contract with San Francisco. And everybody was criticizing San Francisco and was like, you've barely seen what this guy is doing. Why are you paying him this much money? And now they're in the Super Bowl. You know what I mean? Like, they knew what they were doing, but nobody else kind of had the confidence in them.
Okay. One thing to bring up before we close, the Madden curse. Is there any situation, any news that could come out that would convince you that Patrick Mahomes is still cursed by the Madden curse? I mean, what if the Chiefs, it comes out that they were cheating every game? Would that do it? What if, I don't know, is anything going to do it?
I don't know. If the Chiefs start off with the ball, they go out to the 25-yard line, and Patrick Mahomes is sitting there, and he says, hike, and the ball goes over his head. Maybe he's cursed, you know? I don't know.
So, like, Peyton Manning?
That happened to Peyton Manning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about.
But to y'all's point, and y'all brought this up about Tom Brady, boo-hoo, you lost in the Super Bowl. Is that Madden curse worthy?
Here's what I'm saying, though. Tom Brady was kind of humiliated.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it's going to take for me. That's what it's going to take for me to believe in the Madden curse. If they lose the Super Bowl, like, okay, maybe. If Mahomes is humiliated or injured or something like that, then I will be a believer. It's a mystery. I won't be able to explain it, but I'll be a believer.
But I think to that point, the Madden curse would do its job in that he was humbled. Like, if he comes out, all of a sudden, this guy who we're calling the best quarterback ever, who is just being unbelievable in the playoffs, and all of a sudden, he's like 0 for 10. And then ends the game like 5 for 35. that would that would need some explaining.
No, I would believe it. But here's another thing. If they win and he's the MVP of the Super Bowl, are you going to come off of your position, Cole?
Yeah, I will.
You'll stop believing in the Mavericks?
Unless during the offseason something comes out. But yes, to your point, yes.
Okay. So really,
I would say he broke it this one point. And we could also say that he never let the hype get to him. He was humble the whole time, right?
Well, and maybe, you know, he had that injury early in the season.
Yeah. But
and maybe that was like the atoning sacrifice for the full effect of the curse.
Okay.
Like a little humility early in the season stayed off big humility at the end of the season.
Yeah. We'll cross that bridge when we get there. But yeah. Okay.
So I'm just curious to know this. So, like you said, if something happened in the off season, well, how long can something happen?
I meant, like, for instance, Vince Young was going to commit suicide. That was part of his Madden curse. I'm talking if something happens with Patrick Mahomes and he's like, no, let me finish. If something happens with Patrick Mahomes and it's like, oh, he was taking steroids all season long. Or, oh, Patrick Mahomes was paying off other coaches to, you know what I mean? Something like that.
I understand what you're saying. My question, though, is like, what is the time stamp at which point? Because, I mean, something bad will happen to Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah.
And in 20 years when something bad happens to him, are you going to see like, oh, that's the 2020 Madden.
I'm saying in the offseason, something is revealed that he was doing wrong during the season. That's what I'm saying.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't think Vince Young's mental state had anything to do with the Madden curse. But I don't know. That's a little concerning to me. But anyway.
Well, see, my pick, that was the same year with the Bulls, I'm pretty sure. So.
Here's what I want to know. All right, here is what I want to know. I want to know, who are you rooting for in the Super Bowl, Cole?
I'm going to go with the Chiefs.
Okay.
Break the curse. It's fun. It's exciting.
Good choice. Forrest?
You already know.
49ers.
Just on principle. I had a whole segment on how annoying I thought Mahomes is. I can't root for him now. I gotta be consistent.
I'm going for the 49ers. I think I'm gonna trust the Madden curse. And he knocked out the Titans. Forget this guy.
Okay. All right. So Forrest, the last time we played Madden, who did you play as?
The Chiefs.
Oh, okay. Just wanted to point out that hypocrisy.
Because they're great.
Yeah. Look, so who did you play primarily?
When?
During that game. Who did you play as? Like, what character were you primarily?
Do you know how Madden works? You're only the quarterback on offense. Like, you don't get to choose. But it's different. In the virtual world, do I want to take advantage of the algorithm that acknowledges Mahomes' talents? Yes. In the real world, do I want him to be the champion of the world? No.
Yeah, okay, so you admit that he's great. That's all I'm getting at.
He's talented, absolutely. He's great. And he's annoying. You can be both.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted you to admit that he was indeed.
He is good. He's very talented. Okay, good. He's very talented.
I'm going to be rooting for the Chiefs because I think their offense is amazing. It's impressive. It's fun to watch. And I think their defense is good. Yeah, maybe they're not as well balanced and well rounded as the 49ers, but I think they're just gonna go out there and explode and do great. So I'm excited to watch. So it's gonna be a fun Super Bowl. It's gonna be the first time in I think 2-3 years that I'm not gonna be watching the Super Bowl with these guys. So that's sad, but I'm sure we'll be texting throughout all of it. So that'll be fun. We're excited to be back next week talking about the winner of the Super Bowl and what all plays out in Super Bowl 54 and whether or not the Madden curse is real, because I'm sure that'll come up again. So thank you for listening to the football section. Sit right there and listen to Bring It to the Table. ¶¶ well, it is now time for Bring It to the Table. We are, I think, going to talk about Star Wars this week. I think the last time we were all together recording a podcast, I actually left from recording to go watch Star Wars with my brother. I thought it was really good. I was sitting throughout the entire time because me and Forrest, throughout the entire movie, me and Forrest had a conversation about it previously. And I was thinking about everything that Forrest told me. Well, not everything he told me because he didn't like reveal anything, but I was thinking about what he told me, looking for a specific element throughout the movie. And I think there's an actual word that describes this, but it's like something to do with introducing something new for the first time that's never been introduced before without really explaining it. Forrest, elaborate on what I'm talking about.
Yes, there's a couple of different things. There is a literary device, which in I'm not going to try to pronounce the Latin. It just means God from the machine, where it's like something just swoops down and fixes whatever the situation is. So there was that present in the newest Star Wars, but then there's also like things about Force abilities that you never seen in any of the Star Wars movies, and then all of a sudden they're a major part of the plot, and you're like, oh, okay, I guess that's possible. Sweet.
Yeah.
I may have something for you there.
Okay. Let's just get this spoiler alert out of the way now. Like, if you haven't seen the latest Star Wars, just
get
pause
away.
It, go watch it and then come back. So now we can speak freely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I will say this. People spoiled it for me on the radio. I'm listening to sports radio, and it's spoiled. And I'm like, And like, granted, I wasn't shocked because like I knew that that was a theory that, you know, the Sith was going to be there and everything or was going to be behind Smoke or whatever, but Smoke comes from fire. Snoke comes from the Sith. Anyway, so like I knew it was a possibility, but it was still disappointing, you know.
Wait, Snoke was in that movie? Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the clone. Okay.
Yeah, he was in it, but not as a character. Yeah. You just saw his weird looking.
So I will say this. As y'all know, I've been obsessed with Star Wars for like the last 4 months. I played the game. They had a game of Star Wars that just came out. It was phenomenal. You need to go buy it, each one of you, and play it, and everybody listening. One of the things that was revealed in that game was a force ability where they could, it's like a force echo, it's called. So you can, some of these force wielders or whatever you want to call them, can touch something, and they can get a glimpse in the past that happened there. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so certain people have different force abilities, and so that was one of them. And then what's revealed in this movie is the force ability of healing. I'm not sure I've seen that anywhere, but if you look in, no. What I'm saying is in the movies, no. But I'm sure that's in the lore. Either if it's books, the comic books, some of the games, like that's there. It just hasn't been revealed in the movies.
Yeah, and there definitely were hints to it, right? Like when Palpatine tells Anakin that he can save Padme and all this different stuff, like sure, like okay. But that's the bigger thing that kind of gets introduced in the movies. But and like maybe this is a minor point, but it bothered me to no end. I just did not understand what was happening. Mm-hmm. When Rey is down in that town where they get the weird guy to fix C-3PO to read the Sith.
Oh yeah.
And then Kylo Ren is up on the ship. And then somehow they're in the same room fighting each other. But they're not.
Right.
Like, that's the thing where I was just like, I kept being like, okay. Like, it just felt forced to me. Where it was like, we need a fight scene, but we can't write in how they're in the same room at the same time. So there's now this force ability where you can be like, and then maybe she was doing like the Luke thing where it was just like an image of her up there. But then Luke's image never really strikes Kylo Ren in the past movie. Like, it just raised so many questions for me. And I was like, how convenient that we just introduce things the Force can do for the sake of the plot.
Well, I will say this. There's, I think it's called a Dia, which is a double. they're a double in the Force, her and Kylo. And rare, but when it happens, it's really strong. So maybe that ability in that is being able to see one another as they do all throughout the movies.
And I get, like, that's cool and all, but, like...
Where did that come from? Like, that's my thing, too, though. But go
right,
ahead.
Exactly. Like, what? And, like, I don't know, like, to some degree, it's been so abundantly obvious that both of these people are way powerful, way more powerful than anyone else has ever been with the Force, or at least within the movie realm. You know, like, I get that there's a long history of Force use and stuff, but they're more powerful than anyone else that's ever been in the movies. And it feels like that they're just kind of overpowered, you know, because they're just doing things that, like, no one's ever done. Even, like, in the last movie when they were, like, talking to one another from a great distance.
Right.
Like, it's just like, what? Yeah. You know, and I don't know, like, it's just so weird.
They're twins in the Force, though. That's why it's so powerful. It's a rare thing. And it has happened in... Have y'all heard of Star Wars, The Knights of the Old Republic?
Yeah, yeah.
That's rumored to be the next movie. And I'm reading the books on that because I'm interested in it now. And that was way back in the past. And apparently there was one of these twins in the Force back then that was really strong.
Yeah, and I get what you're saying. But, like, to Forrest's point, it's not seen in any of the other movies. You know what I mean? And it's not really explained. Like, you're the first person I've ever heard say twin in the Force. Like, I've never heard of that before. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, I don't know.
And I need clarification on this. In the last movie, before this past one, Kylo Ren tells Rey that he knows who her parents are. And he says, they're nobody. They're filthy junk traders who deserted you. Now, is he lying? Is he trying to make her mad? Does he not know the truth? Or was that a plot hole?
I think it was a plot hole.
You know what I mean? Like, the fact that he said that, and it's like she knew. Like, when you watch it, it's like she knew that that was true. And then, oh, wait, actually, no, your parents were Palpatine's kids. Like, what?
Right.
That's my biggest grief with this movie is they made everyone and there's no plot for all three. They make one movie, they play it out, and then they see the fans' reaction. Then the next movie is a response to the fans' reaction, and you get plot holes. The whole Palpatine thing, they didn't plan that. They were just like, man, we got to do something. The fans are hating us right now. And
And I liked the fact that her parents were no one. Like, I thought that was cool, you know? Like, I thought it was very neat that the Force did not have to be inherited, but rather it could be, you know, just, you could just become as powerful as her through just the blessing of the Force, I guess. I don't know. But I thought it was kind of neat, you know, that they were going to try to go in a new direction.
Here's what I hated about the movie. I love the movie watching it. It was very entertaining to watch, but when you reflect back and you see the plot holes, you're like, ugh. Anyways, Palpatine has been planning for like 20, 40 years, whatever, this massive scheme, the biggest army we've ever seen on a planet, an unknown planet. And then all of a sudden, in like 5 minutes, his grand scheme, this massive planner is put away. Like, your plan was that she was going to turn to the dark side and kill you? That was your plan? I don't know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, like, I don't know. I don't know. Like, yeah, there were a couple of things like that. But at the same time, like, I don't want to be overly critical. It was entertaining. There was a lot of action. You know what I mean? Like, as a movie, it's still fun to go watch. But there's just a couple of things like that just, I don't know. Compared to the tightness that you had in the first six movies.
Right.
Where you're seeing all these things just slide where they need to be. Right. Compare that to we're just flying by the seat of our pants and we're introducing things as they come along. Like, it just doesn't feel the same.
Right.
That there's also, I've heard a rumor, I don't know if this is true, that they might retcon the movies. So they might say, oh, none of that was real. And if they do that, like, okay, I think that would be horrible. You got to take your blow. This was a failure. It's fine. It's a part of it. Don't sit here and retcon it. This is just going to add more confusion.
I see what you're saying, but, like, at the same time, if it meant I got more Star Wars movies, I might be okay with it. Because, like, I do like the Star Wars story. Like, I like that. Because of Marvel, I look at everything as universes. So, like, I like the Star Wars universe, if you will, you know? But I don't know. Like, so I don't know. But I do see your point at the same time. Yeah.
If that's your concern, you have no worries, because I think they're taking a 4 or 5 year break from Star Wars, but we're going to have all kinds of TV shows, like an Obi-Wan Kenobi TV show, a Kylo Ren TV show is going to be on Disney Plus. They're going to continue, I think, The Mandalorian. I think Anakin or Darth Vader is going to be a TV show. That's going to be awesome. Then there's rumors that the next movies, the next series is going to be way back in the past in the Knights of the Old Republic, which was awesome.
That would be really cool. That would be very cool. Here's my question. And I don't know if y'all have tried to do the math or anything. And I know with, you know, him living for as long as he did, that kind of makes things difficult. But is it possible for Palpatine to be this woman's grandfather, considering like the ages of everyone? You know what I mean? Like, it just seems like that timeline is so wide that mathematically it just doesn't work.
You know? No, I think it is possible, but then there's also, because I saw something on this. I don't know if you remember, but Anakin technically is like born of a virgin, and I'm using air quotes, because of the mitochlorians just happened to impregnate his mom. But there's like a fan theory where Darth Plagueis actually manipulated the Force to impregnate her to bring about Anakin, who would be very powerful in the dark side of the Force and would lead to the end of the Jedi. So some people have said that Palpatine could have done that to somebody, and then, you know, they just naturally give birth later. The offspring naturally gives birth to Rey. But even then, because there is quite a bit of time, but I can't think of exactly how much. But that is an option open to them. And that's the thing. Anything you bring up as a possible plot hole...
The Force can explain it.
There's something. Yeah, there's something that could explain it.
That's funny. That's very interesting.
Have y'all heard of, I'm going to bring up, this is completely random, how evil Emperor Palpatine was and how he wanted to take, like, keep control of Vader, but also make him stronger in the dark side. So his suit actually caused Vader pain so that he would stay angry. And so, like, Vader looked forward to his alone time where he could be in, like, this chamber that wouldn't kill him because his suit kept him alive, where he could take it off and relax from that pain for, like, 30 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, I heard about that. I think I watched a YouTube video on that.
Star Wars Theory. That's the YouTube guy. He's really good.
We'll add a link to the show notes.
I don't know. I did think the movie was good, though. Like, I know there were a lot of people who were disappointed. And especially with, I think it was the point Cole mentioned about how, like, every movie's just been a response to the fans' hatred and everything previously and stuff. And I don't know. Like, I felt like the name of this movie, though, The Rise of Skywalker, like, I thought that was a little bit of a stretch. Assuming it's just the connection to her at the very end where, you know, she gives her name as... I'm a Skywalker, you know. It's like
terrible, like whatever. Such clickbait.
Yeah.
And it goes to that whole, like, I am what I identify as. Sorry. Like, you're actually not a Skywalker. You're a Palpatine.
And I wish she would have said that. Like, I felt like there would have been so much more power in the movie if she had, like, owned up to who she was born as.
Right.
Because, like, your family doesn't decide
determine who you are.
Like, you get to determine who you are.
Controversial here. While I was watching the movie, I was so glad Rey turned good or stayed good. I was so glad. And then Kylo, him turning good, I was so glad. But how much better would it have been if Rey would have embraced the dark side with Palpatine and, like, just turned evil? Like, she was a Palpatine. How much better would this movie have been looking back? Because you think about Anakin turning to the dark side. Heartbreaking. Horrible. But that's almost why we respect the movie so much. So what if she would have turned to the dark side, and then, I don't know who, Anakin raises from the dead and they fight it out or something.
Or Kylo Ren. Or Kylo Ren saved the day. Like, that would have been cool.
There was a first draft of the script that became public. Did you see that, Cole? In the first draft of the script, Kylo stays bad and Rey kills him.
See, and I liked that drama.
Yeah.
it made the movies. You got to keep that.
Especially even instead of like that kiss at the end. Like that was just like stupid, you know?
I liked it at the time, but then he turns into a force ghost. I hated that. It was like
he used all of his energy, man. His force juice.
Okay, here's something. He could have lived that fall. It's in the comics. Kylo Ren was trained by Palpatine how to fall from a great height and use the force to survive, which also means Mace Windu could have lived. But it's important because whatever he fell off of, unless it was like hell, he could have survived from it. So he wouldn't have even needed a force ghost. Like he was trained in that way.
And one thing cool that I noticed in each movie, Kylo says, I know what I need to do. In the first movie, he says, I know what I need to do, then kills his dad. In the second movie, he says, I know what I need to do, then he kills Snoke. In the third movie, he says, I know what I need to do, and he throws his lightsaber. And it's like he finally, like incrementally, went to the light side and then was finished. And if you remember, in movie 6, Luke throws his lightsaber so that he doesn't kill his dad. And then that's when his dad comes to the good side and kills, or we thought, kills Palpatine. So there's like some cool like parallelism there.
Okay, yeah, no, that's good. Is cool. That is very
that is
cool.
Good.
Yeah. Star Wars, I mean, it's one of those awesome movie franchises that will forever be cherished, ever be watched. And I'm glad that we had the opportunity to sit and talk about the movie. You know, it's been good, if nothing else, just to hate on it. You know, like, I'm thankful that they did make more Star Wars movies, and I'm excited to see what they do with it in the future. You know, Disney, they've got endless amounts of money, so they will make endless amounts of movies, so that ultimately they're being generous in giving us enjoyment and entertainment. So how about that? We just tied it all together. So,
there you go.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you'll give us some positive feedback and, you know, rate our podcast. We hope that you enjoy listening to it. Hope that you'll share it on Facebook and continue to come back week after week and listen to it. As I'm sure you noticed, the episode was back together as one long episode with music kind of breaking up the segments. And we just decided that that's probably the best way to give our listeners what they want and to allow it to be flexible with our work schedules and whatnot. So we're thankful for you listening, and we hope that you'll come back next week and listen again. Thanks. Have a great day.